Good afternoon and welcome to Coastal Conversations here on WERU. We explore issues facing Maine's coastal communities through dialogue with people who live, work, and play on our coast. From fisheries to tourism, from energy to environment, from economy to ecology, we go beyond the social media soundbites, probing deeply into complex issues and solutions. Coastal Conversations is supported by Maine Sea Grant in partnership with Skudik Institute and the First Coast. I'm Asi Saiduto, the assistant producer of this month's Coastal Conversations. It is 5 p.m. low tide, an evening in late June. A cool breeze brings a salty whiff of the ocean waves, a distant sound of boats and seagulls echoing across the bay. A few friends and I are walking on the rocky shore right out from the College of the Atlantic. Underneath our feet, there are barnacles, seaweed, periwinkles, empty shells, and probably much more. We flip layers of seaweed and small rocks, looking for a little creatures we have heard about for the past few months, the green crabs. We have heard a lot how abundant they are in the Gulf of Maine, so we thought they should be easy to find.
Oh, there we go.
Within 5 minutes of searching, we found 12 green crabs. The biggest ones were about 3 to 4 inches, and there were a few tiny soft-shelled ones as well. I have spent the past few months in an internship at College of the Atlantic, researching and trying to understand what these crabs mean, or can mean to the Gulf of Maine. In this episode, we are going to look at how a small group of people along the Gulf of Maine are trying to educate the public about potential uses for green crabs and expand markets for their products. Before we get into the market side of the green crabs, let's take a brief look at their history. European green crabs are native to Northeast Atlantic Ocean and Baltic Sea. They were transported to the eastern US in the mid-1800s in ships ballast water and were first spotted in southern Maine in the early 1900s. Green crabs has been here for over a century, but their populations have increased dramatically in a warmer climate. The first explosions of their populations was in the 50s, when sea temperature rose significantly, partly due to the influence of El Niño. During that time, green crabs' higher consumptions of crabs shook the crab industry, leading to record low landings. Then, colder winter temperatures in the 60s and 70s suppressed green crabs' population to lower levels. But when water temperatures increased again in the 1980s due to climate change, their populations rebounded and have remained high. Since then, there have been more noticeable negative effects of green crabs on other species through predation, competition for food and space, and negative impacts on critical marine habitats, such as eelgrass and salt marshes through their foraging and burrowing behaviors. Given the long-standing history as an invasive species in the Gulf of Maine, and the positive effect warmer waters have had on their populations in the last 40 years, at this point, biologists and experts agree that eradicating green crabs in the Gulf of Maine is not a realistic or feasible goal. One way to minimize the disruptive impacts on the marine ecosystem and other fisheries is to reduce the population through harvesting them. Or at the very least, perhaps we can turn this invasive into new market opportunities for Maine's seafood economy. There are many researchers that have been studying green crabs. One of those people is Dr. Hillary Smith. Hillary is a research assistant professor of marine policy in the School of Marine Sciences at the University of Maine. She is also a research affiliate at the College of the Atlantic. Her research examines the role of green crabs in Maine's food system. As part of the study, she interviewed people who work with green crabs, and we will hear from some of them later in this episode. This is Hillary.
So I was interested in understanding how people throughout the food system are trying to work with green crabs and sort of benefit from this like abundant resource that's here and is actually continuing to only do better under climate change. As I think the story of green crabs in the case here in Maine is important, but it also has like broader implications with, you know, the ongoing impacts of climate change and continued introduction of invasive species all over the US and all over the world. There are lots of examples of like new or introduced species or species experiencing range shifts due to climate change that are creating altered ecosystems and also new fisheries opportunities potentially. But oftentimes as these shifts happen, it's not necessarily, doesn't always immediately translate into like a profitable, accessible fishery.
Shift in species range do not always mean that a new fishery and market will emerge. It takes people and resources to do the groundwork to build interest in a species and a regulatory environment that supports it. One of the people trying to figure out a green crab market is Mary Parks, a local from Maine. Mary is the founder of GreenCrab.org, a nonprofit organization that plays a significant role in educating, connecting, and promoting information about green crabs to the wider public.
I was born in 1994 in Rockport / Warren, Maine. And I grew up in a lobstering town that was filled with people who were impacted by green crabs.
In middle school years, Mary would swim around Rockport Harbor and saw the green crabs everywhere. Sometimes there were so many that she describes them as a moving carpet. Growing up in Maine surrounded by green crabs, Mary had the curiosity to try to use them in food, even when she was young.
So I caught all these green crabs, and my family and everyone around me was like, you can't eat these, nobody eats them. And I tried to pick them for meat, and it was kind of tough, but the meat was pretty good and it was sweet. Then I made a stock with them, and I was like, this is really, really yummy. And that was like my first green crab stock and crab soup.
She didn't continue to eat or do anything with green crabs after the first trial, even though they were still all over the bay. It was much later when she returned to the idea of using them for food again.
Then it was after college when I started working at a fish wholesaler that I was really seeing so many of these green crabs coming in and being sold as bait. And then I met a group of people in Ipswich, Massachusetts, who had this idea of eating them. Specifically, I met this one man, Jonathan Taggart, who had traveled to Venice through his work as a boat restorer and learned about how green crabs are consumed in their native range. And that was kind of like my first hook into learning that this species that was being sold as bait and considered as bait was really something that had a lot of culinary potential.
The bait market is a large part of the current green crab fishery. They are used to target tautog, striper, and whelks. There are also other markets like composting and pet food. In these markets that are not for direct human consumption, it doesn't matter if you bring a good or bad quality crab, or their sex or size. The price is all the same. The demand is low, and right now, the price of green crabs for these non-food markets in Maine is low, at less than $1 per pound. That's hard for any fisherman to make a meaningful profit off them. That's why only a few folks are harvesting green crabs, despite their abundance and the damage they cause to the ecosystem. Fishermen want to invest their money and time where it is worth it. So Mary thinks that The price could increase if the species were bought and sold for culinary uses. If you search on Google for where can I find, eat, and sell green crabs, the top website that shows up is greencrab.org. Mary and her team at the organizations are working to build the supply chain and educate the public about the culinary uses of green crabs. The small group of people that are currently interested and work on the green crabs market know each other and some work together. Many of them were first exposed to the idea of eating green crabs through greencrab.org website or their outreach events. The organization acts as a hub that connects people together. But how did that start?
Greencrab.org founded in 2020. We founded right before the pandemic started. And that was a really challenging thing because we received a grant from the Mass Seafood Marketing Grant Program that was all about marketing and distributing green crabs. So we framed the start of kind of launching this nonprofit through this Shuck at Home program. When everybody was stuck at home, when access to seafood and the ability to go to fish markets was really, really difficult for a lot of people. And it was a great way to familiarize the public with green crabs, specifically the public in Boston.
During the program, people who wanted the green crabs would sign up, and then Mary and her team distributed 5 pounds of green crabs to them. After that, they also did a green crab giveaway in bulk market and launched the green crabs website with a grant.
Since then, we have expanded two networks, so a chef advisory network and a harvester advisory network that aims to increase chef and harvester participation in the fishery. We've worked with over 40 restaurants to get green crabs out of the water and onto menus. And we've also done some outreach work that's like specific to education with kids. So a Touch Tank series with Save the Harbor, Save the Bay, where we worked with local artist Eileen Riestra to create a green crab coloring book. And also through our advisory networks too, we've hosted a lot of cooking workshops, a lot of events that are specific to harvesters entering the fishery and understanding challenges of the green crab fishery.
Exposures and educations are really key for market expansion. Through the outreach events and collaborations with other organizations, they found that many people are aware of green crabs and their impacts. Even the little kids know how to identify them. But there's very little awareness that green crabs can be eaten, even among the fishermen who commonly encounter green crabs in their work. Awareness of them as food is low.
It's so funny because when I used to work on the fish pier, the number of people who told me we're not interested in selling green crabs. Nobody in terms of our customers are going to be interested in purchasing them. This is a trash species. This is a bait species. And several years later have been reaching out and been like, hey, actually, we've had a lot of restaurants that we work with reach out interested. And actually, we want to start testing carrying them and see how that works out.
The interest in eating green crabs changed when demand started to appear. As chefs began experimenting with them, supported by organizations like greencrab.org, it proved that green crabs can be used in culinary settings, and that change is important. Creating a viable market requires many stakeholders in the food system. It involves harvesters to harvest the green crabs, the wholesaler or dealer to store and distribute them to the market, chefs and restaurants to introduce them to the consumers, and then, hopefully, individuals will purchase and consume them like other seafood. As straightforward as it might sound, the prior associations with green crabs as bait or compost doesn't necessarily support efforts to build the culinary markets, where it can be difficult to change the perceptions of green crabs among powerful actors in the supply chain like wholesalers and seafood dealers.
And so it's also educating them on these are the ways in which chefs can cook with them. These are restaurants that are cooking with them right now. These are some ways that you can talk about how chefs can store them, where they are coming from, and also like the benefits of, for example, freezing them, shucking for roe, seasonality and how that can change. And so getting that information into wholesalers' sales floors, because at the end of the day, those are the people who are often having conversations with the suppliers, but they're also having conversations, more importantly, with restaurants. They're also often setting the tone when it comes to markets, especially early underutilized markets too. So that's super, super important.
After all the outreach events and connections the organizations has been working on, building and connecting actors in the supply chain is one of greencrafts.org's main focuses now. Even though the movement is still small, Mary knows that the narrative of green crafts as food is changing. Another way to speed up and expand the green crafts culinary market is to reach the people who already consume green crafts. You are listening to WERU Community Radio at 89.9 FM and streaming online at weru.org. This is Coastal Conversations. Creating new markets is one way to get people excited about green crafts, but you also need to change consumer perspectives. That can be tricky. Taejong is the Director of Multicultural Markets and Strategies for the Maine State Chamber of Commerce. Tae is working alongside greencraft.org. He proposed a different approach. Instead of trying to change consumer minds and habits, he is trying to bring green crafts to the existing but overlooked consumers who already have culinary traditions of eating small body crabs.
You can't do the entire population at once. I like to keep it simple. I go with populations that are consuming a lot of it and sell more of it to them, have them educate other people why they're consuming more of it, and have people adopt what they're consuming. And that, to me, is the Southeast Asian population. So it could be from Cambodian to Vietnamese to Thai, to Chinese, to Japanese, to, you know, mainstream population restaurants.
Tae was born in South Korea and came to the U.S. at an early age in 1976. Tae has been working with the immigrant community for about 30 years, and he was also involved with the seafood sector. He believes that recent immigrants and people of color can be important to Maine seafood sector. Cambodian Americans eat almost 5 times more seafood than the average American. Japanese, Korean, and Thai eat about 4.5 times more. Also, the scale of that market is not small. The Asian populations in New England covers 5% of the total population. That's around 700,000 people. Tae started to be interested in the idea of selling green crafts to the Asian community during COVID. He was doing a focus group survey with the Cambodian community in Lowell, Massachusetts.
I simply asked them, like, do you eat green crabs? They said, of course. How do you eat them? Well, we stick them in a jar and we salt them and we turn them into fish sauce and we consume hundreds of pounds, and I was blown away by that. So I wanted to test that theory out. So 3 years ago at the Cambodian New Year Festival in Buxton, it's a 2-day holiday. They only let 200 people in per day. And so I gave away 1,500 pounds of green crabs in about 3 hours. And then I did it again last year at the Cambodian New Year Festival in Westbrook. And we gave away 1,300 pounds in about 2 hours.
Tae thought that it was easy to just give away the green crabs. But can he sell them? What's the price point? So he surveys people in his giveaway green crabs projects. People said they would pay for green crabs from $1 to $3 per pound. Tae also did a survey on seafood choice within Asian communities. The most frequent choice was crabs, because they use them for soup base and a protein source. People would consume them from once a week to once a month. The demand already exists within the Asian communities. They know how to use the green crabs and already like to eat them. if building culinary markets is critical to benefiting from green crafts, it makes sense to focus on these communities. Like Mary Parks, Tae also believes that connecting people and building relationships across the supply chains is important. Tae wants to find a way to sell them across deadlines to reach more consumers. But that's quite tricky because green crabs are classified as an invasive species, which means there are specific rules and regulations about how and where they can be moved or sold.
I'm applying for a couple grants where I want to bring the Southeast Asian communities to purchase Indo seafood products on the docks so they can get to know the fishermen. And they can then also tell their friends in New Hampshire and Massachusetts to come up and purchase them. So I'm trying to figure out, like, what permits and licenses do I need to sell green crabs across state lines, especially if it's an invasive species. I've asked DMR. I haven't heard anything. Riley O'Brien is on the, he's a legislature, oversees the seafood sector. He doesn't know. I've emailed people in Boston, you know, like, what licenses do I need to sell those things? Once I have that, I've got, you know, I'm working with Mary Parks from greencrabs.org. She knows a dozen harvesters in Maine that we could just go and sell.
To better understand the challenges Tae was describing, I checked in with Gabriela Brad, a fisheries extension specialist for New Hampshire Sea Grant and University of New Hampshire Cooperative Extension. This is what she said. Federally, green crabs are not regulated under the Lacey Act, a federal law combating illegal wildlife trade. So there are no prohibitions on their transport at the federal level. But the species legislation varies by state. One state may allow for the taking, possession, or sale of the species, while its neighbor does not. In New England, the intended use matters. For instance, in Massachusetts and Maine, green crabs cannot be released back into the water, which limits their transportation across state lines for use as bait. But if the intended use is for culinary markets, and they would not be returned to the water, it is legal to transport them live across state lines within New England. Previously, the only permit for green crab trading for culinary was a wholesale seafood license. But now, there is another option. In May of 2025, the Maine legislature passed a bill allowing harvesters to obtain the green crab-only wholesale dealer license. This license allows green crab fishermen to purchase the species from multiple fishermen and resell them without going through traditional wholesalers. The bill was introduced by fisherman John Painter, the harvester advisor at greencrab.org and the founder of Maine Green Crabs. This new license option allows green crabs to enter the market more consistently. On a small scale, there are innovative products using green crabs that are being developed and coming to market, like Wolffish Company, a seafood wholesaler in Massachusetts that distributes seafood nationwide, started to include green crabs into their product. Said Ours and Company, a company that makes clam and seafood broth, now also include green crabs in their new broth product. A Maine Garam Company is creating green crab fish sauce. Chef and Claw Company is also developing methods for targeting recently melted soft-shelled green crabs, a market that already has a high demand. As Taejong takes part in building the green crab supply chain, another thing that makes him believe in the work he is doing is looking at the big picture of how the species in the seafood industry changed throughout history. There are many seafood species that were once considered trash and are now part of our cuisine.
I'm old, so people never ate pollock. They used to call it trash fish. You know, after work, my brothers and I, we would go fishing and we would catch mackerel. It was like an abundance. And all the people at the dock, whenever they caught a pollock, they would throw it away. And now pollock is, you know, it's something that you consume. Italian Americans in Maine, you know, and you know the story of like Mainers and lobsters in prisons. They used to have riots because it was considered trash fish. It just, the narrative and story has changed. That really, that's what it takes.
Changing the story about green crabs and people's perception of them is the work that Mary Parks and Ta Jong are doing to alter the role of green crabs in the food system. From bait and trash fish to food with strong markets incentivizing fishermen to catch them, helping to reduce their population levels. In the process of creating the supply chain, Ta and Mary have shown that building and maintaining strong relationships is very important. Building markets isn't the abstract work of economies. It is about relationships. And this supply chain will have direct impacts on local livelihood as well as the local environment. At this point, it is unclear which products or approaches will work. But these experiments and collaborations could open doors for more people to get involved in. Here is Dr. Hilary Smith again.
I think one thing I do want to emphasize, and it actually is a quote from Tom Prohl, the farm manager at Wolf's Neck. I thought he said it really well lately, that like solving the quote-unquote problem of green crabs, or at least like benefiting from them, it's not going to be like one big hammer. Like, there are a lot of different ways kind of in the food system we could use them. And a lot of people are experimenting with those different ways at present, and no one person has like solved the problem or figured it out. But the hope is that perhaps quite a few of those different opportunities or pursuits will end up being successful and attract more people to them. And, you know, like when a few of those different things get scaled up a little bit more, that we might actually be, you know, removing green crabs on a larger scale, or and at least benefiting from them more in the sense of a fishery in the state.
Personally, I'm excited to see what's coming next as they continue to build the supply chain. After spending so much time listening and learning more about green crabs in culinary uses, I couldn't help but be curious to try how they taste. So I got some green crabs and made the broth out of them using a recipe from greencrab.org website. And then use the broth to make a Thai dish called tom sap, which is a spicy sour soup with some shrimp and herbs. It was delicious. Thank you for tuning in to this episode. If you'd like to hear that and other episodes of Coastal Conversations, join us on the fourth Friday of each month at 4 p.m. for information, story, and conversations about the issues and people of the Maine coast. That great music you are hearing in the background is called A Following Sea and was composed and performed by Paul Anderson. Thank you to Hilary Smith, Mary Parks, and Ta Jong for agreeing to share their perspectives. And thank you to Galen Koch and Hilary Smith for their assistance in the productions of this episode. My name is Asi Saitutho. And on behalf of Maine Sea Grant and in partnership with Scudic Institute and the First Coast, we wish you a good weekend.